Thanks very much, Dean, and it's a great pleasure to be here and a great pleasure to be back once again in Croatia where, as you say, my family has many friends. We are now nearly 6 years after the start of the great financial crisis and nearly 5 years since the drama of late 2008. And with that lapse of time, we may, I think, usefully reflect on the impotence, even of great events, to affect settled patterns of thought. Today, so far as I'm aware, and unless one of my fellow keynoters has already produced one without telling me, there is no far-reaching statement of a new economics emerging from the crisis. At least none has been published, although I do have a manuscript in my bag. Instead, the competing mainstream tendencies, freshwater and saltwater, as they have been described with a peculiarly North American geographic reference, have in different ways hardened their positions. Philip Murawski will soon surface with a book on how the Chicago School weathered the Great Crisis. I think principally by going to ground, by shutting up while things were really hot, and then by surfacing after a decent interval and starting up again as though nothing important had happened. This is something you can get away with when you feel that your professional position is invulnerable. Yes, they concede the system suffered a shock, but that happens, and recovery follows in the nature of things. And if it doesn't, then something must have gotten in the way, and that something must be a form of interference, usually government action, activism, stimulus, or debt, which is blocking the normal and to be expected resilience of private economies. In its strong form, this view has become what one might call the new crack pottery, according to which, to take a historical extension, one of the lessons of the great financial crisis is to look back to the American New Deal and Great Depression with fresh eyes, and to draw the conclusion that without Franklin Roosevelt, the Great Depression would have ended in 1933. It's a very interesting proposition when you realize that contemporaries, the Great Depression in the United States did end in 1933. The notion that it ended with the Great Second World War is something that was invented afterwards. And contemporaries thought that Roosevelt and the New Deal played an important causal role in bringing the Depression to the end. But no, the lesson we are supposed to take from recent events is that things would have been even better if Herbert Hoover had won re-election. To this, one can add the theory that government caused the great financial crisis in the first place by such well-intentioned but intrinsically misguided policies as fostering home ownership for poor people in the United States, and through, well, the story that we're all familiar with in Europe of reckless overspending in Greece and elsewhere. And then, mirabile dictu, the remedy becomes further deregulation, flexibilization of labor markets, and cutbacks to the welfare state. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. The market, in this interpretation of things, emerges untouched and irreproachable. Attention has been diverted, as it was in Milton Friedman's analysis of the Great Depression, from any defects of the economic system. One has to admire those, and some of my colleagues here have had the extraordinary patience and fortitude to attack and analyze and deconstruct a logic of this type. They have more patience than I do. I'm going to focus, however, I think, a little more attention on the other side of the ongoing discussion. And that is the side represented by the group that today calls itself Keynesians, who have adopted and represented themselves as carrying on in the spirit of John Maynard Keynes. This group, I think, really has no theory of why the crisis happened. It tends to appeal to the metaphorical image of a bubble or a shock and leave it at that. But what they have done is to treat the aftermath of the crisis as a test and a verification of their prior worldview. Thus, the failure of our economies to recover is, in this representation, due to the fact that government did too little, that the stimulus was too small, and that there was a shift too soon to the current overwhelmingly prevalent politics of austerity. In this way, the self-described Keynesians are, in some respects, a mirror image of the Austerians whom they attack, whereas the Austerians argue that full recovery would have occurred if only government had done less. The Keynesians argue that full recovery would have occurred if only government had done more. In an important, but perhaps second-tier way, the self-described Keynesians also converge with their Austerian rivals in the long run. They accept the argument that belt tightening, fiscal consolidation is the present euphemism, that austerity should come later, after the promise of full recovery has been realized. This leaves them open to accepting the attack on the welfare state, so long as it doesn't happen too soon. Open to accepting that basic social protections, labor rights, regulatory standards, and minimum wages should be brought into question once the economy has been restored to health. In the US, this makes them vulnerable to concede the merit of proposals that can be enacted now to reduce programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid later on. The current telling example is the proposal, which is in President Obama's budget, to shift the basis of calculation of the cost of living in Social Security to a chained index that would have the effect of reducing the benefits paid to increasingly elderly people over a lengthy period of time. Very little effect in the present, but guaranteed to make a substantial difference in 20 or 30 years. Thus, there is a policy difference between this group of, again, self-described Keynesians and the austerians in the near term, but not such a big one in the long-term future. More broadly, the austerians and what I will call the false Keynesians, to be blunt about it, share the view that the pre-crisis era defined a viable trend for the growth of total output going forward, that is to say, for long-term economic expansion, and that what happened is that the crisis interrupted actual growth, but not the potential for growth, and that the success of policy is to be measured by the speed of return to the prior growth track. It's a formula that anybody who studied the MIT-based growth theories of the 1950s and 60s, I think, can recognize, and it's accepted, broadly speaking, by both sides. Both are now disappointed, and each blames the other, as I've said, for the failure to return already after 5 years to that track. The debate appears to be a bitter argument, but then also from time to time, so were the quarrels that one can read about in Lewis Carroll between Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Now, the path of a well-disciplined person in this highly charged political environment is surely to take sides. And to be done with it. And if that is what we have to do, and if the choice is between Neil Ferguson, whom I had the displeasure of listening to a couple of nights ago at the OECD in Paris, or Paul Krugman, then I won't hesitate. Choice is plain. But you don't have to find these competing views to be equivalent in order to take exception with, indeed to reject them both. And that's what I propose to try to do. I have actually tried from the beginning of the crisis to articulate what one, I suppose, in a tradition not unknown in this part of the world, might call a third way. That is to say, to reject a shallow bipolarity. And I did this beginning really in March of 2009 with an article in the Washington Monthly entitled No Return to Normal. And I'm working on it still in the manuscript that I mentioned a few minutes ago, which will be entitled The End of Normal. As I write, certainly views and ideas evolve, but let me just sketch out for you what I think to be the essential issues in the present state of play. First of all, it seems to me that we should accept that this crisis was not a one-off shock to a growing system brought on by chance or by some adventitious event such as the real estate bubble. Paul Krugman, in an article in the New York Review of Books just published, writes, "In the beginning was the bubble." as though we don't have to address that phenomenon in any serious way. Nor was it the result of any other simple one-off cause, one-note narrative. What we observed instead, it seems to me, was the final breakdown, the culminating effect in the United States, particularly, of stresses on what had become, long before, a crippled system. Barely maintained afloat since the crash of the information technology sector in the spring of 2000, the crash of the NASDAQ, by a sequence of stopgap measures. Moreover, if one looks back even further at the prior period from 1975 to 2000, one can see that this was already a growth period quite different from the one that had prevailed in the quarter century before that, from, let's say, 1945 to 1970 or 1950 to 1975. Globally, the difference was that the possibilities for sustained economic growth everywhere had already become quite limited by resource costs and other factors. And so, whereas in this earlier period, the world economy grew quite quickly and developing countries grew more rapidly than developed ones, in the later period, and especially between 1980 and 2000, and something emerges very clearly from work that I've done on economic inequality, you have a vast divergence between the rich countries that continue to grow and the poorer countries that are stalled out or in decline. What is this telling you? It's telling you that growth in the second period was substantially closer to being a zero-sum game, coming in some regions at the expense of others. Otherwise, the rise of inequality that we do observe on a global scale would not have occurred. Now, in 2000, what we saw, centered in the United States, but it was a global phenomenon after all, was the peaking of the last great credit-fueled business investment-based expansion. And when that crested and crashed, the underlying problem of the rising cost of real resources could no longer be effectively disguised in the rich countries. I think it's actually no accident, when you think back on the political history of this moment, it's no accident that interests closely related to the energy sector seized power by a judicial coup, right? Let's not forget, not by election, but by a 5-4 decision in the Supreme Court in the United States. Right? They were in urgent need of it, as they saw, because had a different president taken power, the military resources that were quickly then brought to bear in the energy-rich parts of the world might not have been so readily available. Energy and resources are, of course, the great missing topic in the neoclassical theory of growth going back to the 1950s. There was an effort to bring them into play in the 1970s, and the economics profession, both poles of the current discussion, the freshwater and the saltwater, reacted to it allergically, rejecting the notion that this particular problem needed to be taken seriously at that time. And for a substantial period after that, given the high dollar and the debt crisis, and the depressed world commodity prices after 1985, we were able to pretend that this position was viable, that one could, in fact, neglect the energy question. I think what we saw after 2000 was yet another effort to bring this issue under control, this time with the direct application of military power, and what we learned was that military power in the modern world isn't good for very much, that it has extreme limits on what it is capable of achieving. It is perhaps also true that the goals were not well defined, that the preparations were completely inadequate, but the lesson that we learned in Iraq and then in Afghanistan, and I think the world has learned, is that the sweep of military power, that let's say the balance of forces has moved against the effective application of military power, no matter how dominant it appears to be in advance. What had we gotten as a Western economic center, and particularly in the United States, out of the apparently dominant position that we had at the end of the Cold War? The answer is we got a currency system built around our financial sectors. A worldwide economy rooted in what has been called the exorbitant privilege of the dollar. And that system survives to this day, but no one knows and no one can say how long a monetary system will remain at the center, any particular monetary system will remain stable in the world economy. Typically, the half-life of these systems is maybe 30 or 40 years. Finally, a third, I think, factor that one needs to point to in the build-up to the crisis is the character of the technological changes that drove the world economy, but particularly in the advanced countries, forward at the end of the 1990s. There was a classic investment boom rooted in information technology. And that brought us, and along with us, much of the advanced world, to full employment for a period of years. And then it came to an end. In the aftermath, one has to take account of what the technology was best able to do. And the answer to that, I think, is clearly saving labor. That is, say, reducing costs. It's an extremely powerful tool for the reorganization of business in the face of cost pressures and a squeeze on profits. That tool was not deployed in advance of the crisis because business typically doesn't do that unless it's forced to. But the crisis, in effect, became a kind of purge of advanced country labor forces, massive reduction in the employed population and the employment to population ratios, which we have seen has not been followed by a recovery of private hiring. And I would argue that we see in that not just a failure of demand, but a change in the strategic organization of the private business sector, such that it needs much less labor going forward than it thought it did 15, 20, 25 years ago. Technology must play a role in that. An irony of the argument I'm just making is that it forces me to say a sympathetic word about the greatly unlamented former President George W. Bush. I will keep it brief, but there is a tendency to place these events in political terms and to say, well, the crisis happened under George Bush's watch and it must therefore be his fault. And I think this would not be historically accurate. What actually happened is that George Bush took power in a crisis that was already unfolding and proceeded for a half a dozen years to throw stopgap measures at it to prevent it from developing too rapidly. The tax cuts were the first example. The war spending, particularly for Iraq in 2003, was the second phase. In 2004, the American executive branch under a Republican administration told the Congress to spend as much money as it liked, which it then did. And most important, all through this period, an administration which understood very well the workings of the housing finance sector encouraged the extension of loans against real estate assets in the United States that the mortgage originators knew very well would never be repaid, would have to be refinanced or would default on terms that were designed to explode, to be non-viable a few years down the road. And those mortgages were then marketed to the world in the greatest wave of financial fraud that human history has ever seen. That is to say, with the connivance of the ratings agencies, as everybody knows, giving AAA ratings to packages of loans that were destined to collapse because, as it was later discovered, there was fraud, abuse, or missing documentation in virtually every file. The investment banks and the commercial banks had been deregulated and desupervised and who had been given very explicit guidance about what would not be checked in their behavior, proceeded to infect the entire world with toxic financial assets. And that, of course, lasted until people recognized what was going on, at which point it collapsed. But it collapsed. The collapse was not something that happened in a, as I say, one-off fashion. It was the collapse of a final effort to shore up a house whose foundations had washed out long, long ago. If you see things in this way, it perhaps helps us to understand what happened in Europe, where by dint of repetition, we have been confused into thinking that there were a series of national crises, each of them with a distinct local cause. Overspending in Greece, housing boom in Spain, a commercial real estate boom in Ireland, and I'm not exactly sure what in Portugal, but it was Portugal after all. They've never been very competitive. Something must have been going wrong. Right? You can easily allow yourself to chase a rabbit down those various rabbit holes and not to see what was clearly the picture, which is to explain why all of this happened at the same time, why this all unfolded beginning in early 2009. And the answer to that is very clear. We have a worldwide investment community which realized that it was going to take massive losses on assets that it had purchased from the United States. And it did what an investment community can be expected to do. It looked around in its portfolios for weak assets that it could sell before they collapsed, and for strong assets it could buy. And so it dumped the sovereign debts of the peripheral European countries and bought the sovereign debts of the core European countries and of the United States, with the result that yields rose enormously in the weak countries, and they were plunged into a crisis of unsustainable finance, while yields fell on Germany, on Britain, and in government bonds in the United States. We thus have a crisis which is an integrated and ongoing affair implicating all of the advanced industrial economies. And the question then is it legitimate to speak of structural as opposed to merely demand-side obstacles to recovery? And I think it's clear, if my argument is correct, that it is. And there are three of them, roughly. The first is what I'll call the choke chain effect of energy prices, which we have already seen at least once in the aftermath of the crisis, that is to say, with signs of automatic stabilization and some recovery, you get a run-up in the price of energy products, which drains demand effectively as any tax. And that run-up is accelerated by the fact that you have the capacity now to store energy products in order to take advantage of the speculative movement in those prices. Running up against systems that have very high fixed demands for energy, this is a great drain on the capacity for sustained growth, and it also creates an important element of business uncertainty. Because if you're an energy user, you don't know when the price is going to go up, and if you're an energy alternative energy producer, you don't know when it's going to go down. And so caution suggests that you will be less aggressive in moving to a recovery strategy, private sector business recovery strategy, than you might otherwise have been in the past. Secondly, as I said before, the effect of the aftermath of the information technology revolution is a massive wave of labor saving. And we have not created institutions to bring the people who are displaced back into employment or to give them comfortable retirements that would enable them to be out of the labor force and to be supported at the standard at which the economies can easily afford. An advantage of a technological revolution is it does reduce the cost of living, but that's only useful if you happen to have an income with which you can enjoy it. And third, most, I think, flagrantly, is the failure in the crisis to reduce the scale of a bloated, purposeless, dysfunctional banking system, both in the United States and in Europe. A system which does not move and will not move back into the financing underwriting of business loans. It long ago found that line of work to be unprofitable, to be replaced by very much less expensive statistical means of evaluating loans, which then collapsed, yet which continues to impose great costs on private business, that is to say, the cost of interest on the credit they do get, and to operate in practical control of state power. Therefore, in effect, making sure that the burden of policy is toward preserving the banking institutions rather than fostering stable improvement in living standards or employment. There are major differences, I think, between the United States and Europe, and I want to touch on them briefly. And I think the situation actually, given what I have said, is substantially more resilient in the United States than it is on this side of the Atlantic. First thing is that the United States has had, since the New Deal and the Great Society, a very comprehensive network of automatic stabilizers that work at the federal and therefore at the continental level. Social Security, Medicare, disability, food stamps. Food stamp recipients went up from 45 to 70 million in the course of the crisis. Overall, the share of government support for incomes went up very quickly, something like 8 percentage points of GDP, offsetting to a very large degree the fall in incomes that occurred in the crisis itself. Now, that's also true in the core countries of Europe. It's true in Germany. But it is not true in the peripheral countries, where the effect of such, first of all, the institutions were never very strong, and secondly, the austerity policies were put into effect to prevent them from operating in an effective way. And so you had tremendous crash of incomes, ongoing crash of incomes in multiple countries across the European and Mediterranean region particularly, which has no direct counterpart in the United States. Secondly, of course, there is the incipient boom in natural gas, and we shall see what happens. I am not an optimist about it, but there are people who are. Thirdly, There is the fact that in the United States, the debts that were at issue were substantially personal debts, household debts. In many states, situations where you have non-recourse on the mortgage, which means all you have to do is to leave your house to the bank and go rent someplace else, at a minimal reduction of living standards in many cases, and you are no longer in debt. Okay? Now, that's not a happy resolution, and many tens of thousands resisted, many millions resisted who are threatened with foreclosure. But the fact that the debts are personal means that over time they either get paid down or they get defaulted, and eventually they go away. This is not true of sovereign debts. Sovereign debts are on the books until they are renegotiated and written off. And that is a political process that encounters political obstacles that individuals basically don't face. And third, we have actually the benefit of the political gridlock that we have been living under up till now. Sequester seems to have caused some real damage, but up till a certain point, it was just as hard to reduce public benefits as it would have been to increase them once the initial stimulus package was in. So the institutions which were in place were preserved by the fact that it was very difficult to change anything at all. And that, again, is not the case in Europe, where you have the capacity of the Troika to impose brutal conditions on particular governments and very little capacity of those governments to directly resist the application of those policies. So as I've said, in Europe, the automatic stabilizers do not apply in parts of the region. There is no incipient energy boom outside perhaps of Poland, as I understand it. The debts are public, must be negotiated or repudiated, and the strong are not checked by the political resistance of the weak. We are continually told, as a habit of economic forecasting, and again at the OECD just a couple of days ago, we got another dose of this, that things will turn up in 6 months or a year. In the United States, the Congressional Budget Office has been making the same forecast every year. They roll it back and say the track to full employment in 5 years will start in 6 months. It is perhaps reasonable for any sane individual to begin to doubt the process that generates forecasts of this type, and to suggest that if what they do, what they serve to do, is to reinforce a continuation of present policies, they are part of a problem that will not get better. And so radical steps are required. Steps that are within the framework of the European Charter are on the table. The modest proposal of our friend Yanis Varoufakis and Stuart Holland, which calls for mutualization of the European debt structure, an investment program operated through the European Investment Bank, and a true banking union, a common regulatory framework, and the end of the nexus that ties national banks to national governments, all could be achieved within the framework of the European Charter. To this, I have added the thought that what Europe needs is not a stimulus program so much as a stabilization program operating through the incomes of individuals, increasing the security of retirees, increasing the security of the unemployed, that is to say, a mutual unemployment insurance program, things that would effectively stabilize the incomes of the populations of the periphery. I think that augmented version of the modest proposal would, if enacted, be sufficient to do a great change in the mood in Europe. Chances of it being enacted are effectively zero. And that being so, we're left with two choices. And I will leave this audience, which is, I'm sure, familiar with them, to ponder or to think about what I have to say here. Both of them based on models that are not so long ago, and not so far away. One choice is a negotiated dissolution, the Czechoslovak model, okay, in which the debts are written down by the process of separating the euro into two currencies, one of which, the German one, is not the euro anymore, but appreciates, and such that German industry can deal with its own problems that will emerge, but that the debtors have a relief of their burden through a depreciation of the debts. That is at least less disorderly than the alternative, which would be the breaking off, beginning probably with Cyprus, of individual countries from the Eurozone. There's an argument to be made that Cyprus has already paid the price of exiting the Eurozone, is already under the very severe constraints, economic breakdown that would follow an exit, and that it might be better off formalizing what has already occurred. That argument is being made. But it's obvious that it would not stop there, and that the disaster that has visited on Cyprus would follow very quickly to a number of other countries. And that may happen in any event when political forces bring about changes of government in those countries, something which will happen quite soon in at least one or two cases. And the process of progressive dissolution does not stop at national borders. It's something which has an intranational component, as the richer elements of the community decide that they do not wish to continue to support the poorer elements of the community. And we hear about this in Catalonia and Spain at the moment. And this is obviously something which has the capacity to disintegrate, to deteriorate quite quickly toward a very sad sequence of events. And I hesitate to say this, of course, in this setting, in this place, but one could call this the Yugoslav model. Okay. One could call this the threat of a move to a kind of violence that I'm sure people remember and nobody wishes to see again. But I think that's a danger that's frankly out there. And as one moves back from that, one has to say, okay, perhaps we should consider an alternative. The difficult step of a negotiated settlement, or the politically impossible but highly desirable step of large stabilizing reforms before we are pushed anywhere close to that point. Thank you very much.